Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Chris French. He is Emeritus Professor and Head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department at Goldsmiths, University of London. And tonight we're continuing our conversation about his book, The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. Chris, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again about this book. I love this book.
Very kind of you.
Well, what's important about this book is, first of all, it deals with a lot of interesting subjects that people believe in or have heard about. But then it also deals with the way our perceptions work. And that's an important lesson, I think, for all of us to read about some of these findings about how our memory works, how our visual perception works. And it's a fascinating combination.
Well, yeah, that's what I was aiming for. So I'm very pleased if you think I managed to pull it off.
Now, tonight we're going to be talking about high spirits. So, now, let's start with ghosts. The belief in ghosts is common, as you write, throughout history in so many cultures. But the weird thing is, or maybe not the weird thing, this is the least weird thing, the way the ghost acts, the way the ghost appears, the way the people interact with ghosts varies from culture to culture. So there's no consistent idea of what a ghost is.
That's right. And that, for me, is a really kind of a really important point, because one would assume that if ghosts really do exist, then there's some kind of manifestation from some kind of eternal afterlife. In which case we would not expect that variation across time and across geographical areas, but that's what we get. The kind of ancient Greeks idea of what a ghost was is very different to our modern Western idea. And that, to me, very strongly supports the idea that reports of ghosts are basically kind of something that's produced by particular belief systems within particular cultures at particular times.
And the important thing is, if ghosts are real or were real, it's a very important big question for our cultures, because it means it answers ideas about life after death. So fooling around, you know, trying to understand what this is that people are seeing or experiencing is really critical for us to understand ourselves as humans.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's got huge kind of philosophical implications.
Yeah.
For one of the big outstanding questions within philosophy and science is what's known as the hard problem. And the hard problem is basically, it's called the hard problem because it's hard.
Good one.
it's what is the nature of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, and to my mind, although we've made, you know, great progress in terms of understanding how the mind works, we're still so far away from answering that question.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you've got two basic approaches. There's more than two, really, but you know, at the most basic level, you could have, on the one hand, the kind of dualist approach, which was what the great philosopher René Descartes proposed, that mind and brain are kind of two different kinds of stuff. You've got physical stuff like tables and atoms, tables, brains, cakes, whatever, you know, they are things that can be weighed, measured, they have a particular size, location, etc., etc. And then you've got mental stuff, which according to Descartes was of a completely different nature. Obviously, you can't measure thoughts and dreams and mental things in the same kind of a way. So he proposed these two different kinds of substance in the universe. But then you get the problem, well, how can they interact? If you've got an immaterial mind, how can it control a material body? You know, so the other approach is to say, well, okay, maybe dualism's wrong. Maybe we'll go for one of the varieties of monism. There's just one kind of stuff. You can either say that everything is mental, and the notion of there being a physical universe is wrong, or you say everything is physical, but then that doesn't really appeal to our intuitions. I mean, you know, mental stuff does feel different to kind of physical stuff. So at the end of the day, I don't think anybody's solved that one yet. They ever will, I don't know.
I'll tell you, I went under anesthesia for surgery, and that experience, which I was very curious about, really put me in the second category. Like, I don't believe there's a separation. I had total absence of consciousness, which I've never even experienced while sleeping. I've never felt mm-hmm. like that before. And then when they were bringing me out of it, it was like my first thought was that I was aware of being aware. And it really made me really, in my gut, really feel like this is all part of the body. It's a manifestation of the body that we don't understand, but it's connected to the body. Now, let's talk about ghosts. Get back to ghosts. Otherwise, we're going to get lost in consciousness.
Yeah.
Is almost all the evidence for ghosts anecdotal?
Almost all of it, yeah. I mean, basically, if you kind of buy books on ghosts, you'll find endless anecdotes and kind of stories being kind of reported of the "it is said that" variety, you know, usually with very, very little detail. Now, that's not always the case, obviously. There are some kind of famous ghost reports that have been kind of, you know, investigated at the time that they were said to be occurring. But by and large, it's mostly anecdotal. And the problem with anecdotal evidence is that it's just not got much value in scientific
That's
terms.
Right.
Because
you can't study it. You can't predict when it's going to happen.
Yeah, any kind of spontaneous thing like that is difficult to pin down and study it, as you say. And we know that people sometimes make mistakes, and we know that sometimes people just make stuff up. So in terms of, you know, in that respect, anecdotal evidence is not of much scientific value, which is a problem when it comes to kind of trying to take a scientific approach to topics like ghosts.
Now, you wouldn't conclude, therefore, that all reports are hoaxes, though?
No, I think this is sometimes some skeptics kind of immediately go for the kind of line of, oh, it's just all made up, it's just all lies. There are some very famous cases of hoaxes. Tends to be the kind of more spectacular cases, as far as I can see. So I think most people have probably heard of the Amityville Horror.
Yeah, you talk about this in the book, and there's another one I hadn't heard of, the Columbus Poltergeist.
Yes, that's another one. There are a few other cases where we can be absolutely certain that we were dealing with a hoax. It was not, you know, it wasn't being honestly reported, or rather, we've identified who the hoaxer was and how they were achieving the effects. We can't say we know that about all poltergeist type cases or all ghost cases, because typically you'll find that skeptics are not actually welcome to investigate these things. People want it to be paranormal. I mean, it's a great news story while it's, so, you know, possibly paranormal. The moment somebody says, oh no, we figured out it was just somebody playing a joke, then that's not really a news story, you know.
Well, it's amazing how long it may take for the hoax to be revealed. We're going to be talking about spiritualism in a little bit, but the Fox sisters and that phenomena, they finally admitted it was a hoax, that they were just doing it with their toes and their ankle bones or whatever. They were creating those noises. But it's like that doesn't make the papers as much as the original occurrences.
It never does. No, you'll find that far more people know about the kind of claim that the Amityville Horror was a true story, which it said on the front of the best-selling book that topped the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list for months on end. Scared me to death as a teenager.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that not so many people know that the whole thing has been thoroughly debunked. And that it's always going to be that way, you know. And it's interesting with the Fox sisters. As you say, it took about 40 years before they finally fessed up. And there's another interesting case where a schoolgirl prank got out of hand, which is not to do with ghosts, but the Cottingley Fairies.
Oh, that's the one that was investigated by H.G. Wells.
There were kind of various kind of investigations. The thing is, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
It was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, excuse me, not H.G. Wells.
Took it very seriously. He believed it and wrote a book about it.
Oh, my God. And the funny thing is, when you look at the supposed photographs of the fairies, God, do they look obviously faked.
Yes, well, they do to us now. But this is the thing, that for a true believer, they want it to be true. So the evidence doesn't really have to be that convincing for them to accept it. And I think that's particularly the case with ghosts. Although ghosts are a kind of scary idea, they're also evidence for life after death. and we don't like the idea of our own mortality. So I think that's where the kind of motivational side comes in. You know, any evidence, it will be accepted if it supports what we already either believe or what we want to be true.
You go through in the book several different ideas about what could be really going on. One of them is misinterpreting natural phenomena. And there's a case that you talk about in the book that I think is absolutely hilarious. It took place in 2019. It was Stephen McKears and his garden shed. Now, I found that amazing.
I think it's one of my favorite examples. I mean, when I do talks on this topic, I can actually show the relevant video, but just to kind of fill in your listeners, this was a chap who had a garden shed. He used to had a workbench in there. He would spend his day tinkering about at his workbench, and he was fairly untidy. He'd just leave everything spread out all over the desk, lock up, go to bed for the night, come down the next morning, and everything had been tidied away, and he could not figure out what was going on. This went on for months on end. It's kind of like an anti-poltergeist rather than going around. It was tidying up. It sounds great. And eventually, with a next-door neighbour, he set up a video camera. They recorded what was going on, and it turned out it was a little house-proud mouse that would appear after he'd locked up, and it would just put all the bits back in the toolbox. And this clip is on YouTube. Your listeners can check it out for themselves. It's very cute. but if a skeptic had suggested that as a possible alternative explanation, they'd have been laughed at, understandably. But,
I'll tell you, the what it really was is just as wild. I think that's – I'd like one of those mice in my house to help me straighten out. Now, you write that context and prior belief in ghosts is also critical when we're evaluating these reports. And just you should just explain why. I mean, obviously, these things are going to affect how people are interpreting these phenomena.
Yeah, exactly. 'Cause, I mean – I think one thing to make clear is that often when we're talking about kind of ghostly encounters, I think for a lot of people that would summon up a kind of mental image of some translucent figure walking through the wall and across the room and going through the opposite wall and disappearing. In fact, most ghostly encounters are not that spectacular. Those things are reported sometimes, you know, but more often than not, it will be much more milder anomalous experiences. Things like going into a room and feeling some kind of sense of presence. You feel as if you're not on your own, there's someone else in there. Or hearing strange noises in the night. Or maybe smelling perfume or the tobacco from somebody who's passed away. That kind of thing is much, much more subtle. And so these are the kind of sensations that we're talking about, but I think probably most of us have maybe had this experience at some time of, say, you've been shown around a stately building. I mean, do you have those in America? I can't remember. Sorry.
Whoa, that was a slam. Oh, my God.
Over here, we've got them teeming.
You're up to your armpits in stately buildings.
So you've been shown around one of these places and your guide says, oh, and this bedroom is supposed to be haunted. And the moment you go in there, your mental attitude changes.
That's
right. You notice things that you wouldn't notice, creaks, drafts, whatever it may be. And if you're that way inclined, you may well interpret that as some kind of evidence of something paranormal. So that's the kind of context thing. And that's been shown in studies. You know, they've actually carried out studies where you manipulate people's expectations, and it does have that effect.
We have a cemetery that's on a long dirt path. It's out in the middle of the woods, and it's called Spider Gates Cemetery because it has these these beautiful wrought iron spider webs with spiders in them, and people tell all sorts of stories about this. And I once took one of my classes that was studying stuff like this, and we were out there, and it was in night, and I was talking about how all the stories, because it looks like a place that should be haunted. And sure enough, you know, two carloads of drunken frat kids came in, and we hid behind gravestones, and then when we popped out, they really almost had a conniption. But then we were hearing all these stories from them, you know, that there was a story that there was a gravestone that said if you danced on it, the ghost would appear. They went on, and it was a place that looked like it should be haunted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting as well, because, there are certain places that even if you don't know in advance that they're supposed to be haunted, there are certain places that just look and feel spookier than others.
But I bet you those are culturally defined, too. I bet you within Western culture, what would look like it should be haunted is different from if you were to look at a Southeast Asian culture or a Native Australian culture. There would be different places that would look differently that are supposed to be haunted.
I suspect that is probably the case. I think you're right there. But some of the factors probably would be common across those. So for example, when people have looked at these kind of things, trying to look at it systematically, some of the factors are pretty obvious. If you go from an area that's brightly illuminated into an area that's very dimly illuminated, inevitably you feel a bit more anxious. You feel, if you go from somewhere with a low ceiling to somewhere with a high ceiling, and again, this in evolutionary terms all makes sense, because in our evolutionary past, we have to be on the lookout all the time for potential threats around us, and so anything that might be lurking in a dark corner or might be somewhere up above us that could jump down on us is going to make us feel anxious, So I think we can explain those things kind of fairly rationally. But I think, as you say, some of the others would be kind of much more culturally specific,
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Chris French. He is Emeritus Professor and Head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department at Goldsmiths, University of London. And we are continuing our conversation about his book, The Science of Weird Shit, one of the best titles of this year. Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. And tonight we've been talking about spirits and ghosts. There's so many interesting perceptual sort of booby traps that we fall into, and they have different titles and names, and you expound on them throughout the book, like inattentional blindness. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah.
And there's some great experiments about this, too.
There are indeed. I'm kind of slightly hesitant because it's kind of one of those things that I'll probably spoil for some of your listeners, but I'll probably have to actually give you a description. The classic study of inattentional blindness was reported in 1999 by Simons and Shebris. They showed their participants a brief video of some people with white T-shirts on, some people with black T-shirts on, throwing a ball to each other. And your task was just to count the number of times the people in the white shirts threw the ball to each other, ignore the people in the black shirts. And when the task had been completed, you asked how many, and they'd give you an answer. But did you notice anything a bit unusual? Now, the thing is that halfway through this video, someone in a gorilla suit walks right through the middle of the group in plain view, stands there beating their chest for a few seconds, and then walks off. Now, intuitively, you think something so incongruous would grab your attention. Surely you wouldn't miss it. But what you find is that around about half the people who did the counting task did not see the gorilla. And this is a pretty amazing result. And that phenomenon of failing to perceive something, even if your eyes are directly pointing at it, is known as inattentional blindness. Really important phenomenon, because a lot of fatal accidents occur because people don't see what's happening right in front of them. Now, my wife is also a psychologist, and she'd done quite a lot of research on inattentional blindness. She contacted me one day to say, did I have a scale, pencil and paper measure, to administer to measure the personality dimension of absorption. Now, if you score highly on this measure, then you are the kind of person who, if you are reading a novel or watching a film or even doing a crossword puzzle, you completely shut off the outside world. And we kind of thought that ought to correlate with susceptibility to inattentional blindness. And I was intrigued because I knew that absorption correlates with the tendency to report paranormal experiences and with paranormal belief in general. So we thought, well, let's look at it all in one experiment, which we did. We didn't use the gorilla task, but we used a similar type task. And indeed, we found that the people who were inattentionally blind scored higher on our measure of absorption and also on a measure of paranormal belief and experience, which kind of raises the possibility that maybe sometimes when people are giving you their paranormal anecdote, that maybe there was a kind of mundane explanation. There was something around at the time that could have given a very easy explanation, but they just didn't see it. So hypothetically, imagine somebody says, oh, they were in a room and there was nobody else in the room, and while they weren't looking, a book moved from one side of the room to the other.
Right.
You might say, well, maybe there was someone else in the room with you. Oh, no, of course not. I'd have seen them. Well, would you? Because people don't see a gorilla. So that was kind of quite interesting. But another example of the unreliability of eyewitness testimony.
Well, and that's one of the big takeaways of your book is the fallibility of memory. I mean, memory and perception, and this is quoted in your book, is a constructive process. Without even intending anything or our memories are easily fooled or easily misled.
Exactly. Yeah, it's true. And of course, we don't feel, none of us feel that way. I just said my wife is also a psychologist. We're both fully aware of how unreliable memory can be, and yet we still have those typical husband-wife arguments about, I told you to pick up some milk on the way home. No, you didn't. We're both kind of convinced we're right, even though we know that's silly and irrational, and that we all make mistakes.
You end up, if you're married long enough, you don't have those arguments anymore. you just learn when to fold it and then move on. It's important because there's a great example. You talk about Uri Geller and the spoon bending. That was all the rage decades back. And people, you're reporting that even when he put the spoon down, it continued to bend. And it was based on eyewitness testimony, but it was totally unreliable. That it was what's called memory conformity. I mean, everybody, somebody mentions it and everybody else goes, yeah, it did. It was still bending when he put the spoon down.
That's right. I mean, it's the power of suggestion is kind of at the root of that there. My good friend Richard Wiseman did a really nice study that we then kind of built on. His study was to show people a video of an alleged psychic who was, in fact, a conjurer using sleight of hand, who, after he has bent a key using sleight of hand, in one condition, the participants hear the psychic, in scare quotes, say it's still bending. And in the other condition, it's exactly the same, but they don't get that suggestion. Those that do, about 40% of them report that they think the key carries on bending when it absolutely doesn't. In the other condition, virtually nobody does. So we borrowed Richard's video for our study of memory conformity because we liked Richard's results. They were really interesting, but we thought there's something else we can do here. We had our participants watch the video in pairs, discuss with each other what they'd seen, and then report back to us independently. Huh. Now, what the real participants didn't know was that the other person in the pair was a Confederate who was working with us, who had been instructed to either say during the discussion it did carry on bending or it didn't. And that had an additive effect. If you're in the condition in our experiment where you got both the suggestion from the psychic and the reinforcement from the co-witness, we got up to levels of 60% of people reporting they thought the key carried on bending. And what that illustrates is that, something we already knew, but it's nice to kind of study it in an anomalistic context. It's not just what's happening while you are witnessing an event that will affect your memory. Stuff that happens afterwards can also affect your memory.
It's amazing. We only have a few minutes left. There's a great section on communication with the dead and mediums and seances. And I found the section on cold reading to be particularly fascinating, sometimes called the Barnum effect or the Forer effect, about how people do cold readings when they're doing contact with, dead relatives and so and so forth. It's amazing, it's been experimentally proven that believers will remember the hits, not the misses.
Well, this is it. I mean, cold reading is a whole kind of, it's a set of techniques, really. It's not just a single technique. The Barnum effect is one of them. That refers to the fact that there are certain kinds of statement that sound as if they're saying something kind of very profound about your innermost personality, but actually they apply to everybody.
Yeah, and it's incredible because you give sample questions, or sample answers, and it's amazing if you start writing down what your answers are. you'd start believing that, oh my God, how did this person do this?
That's it. And so, a basic kind of Barnum profile. If I want to convince a complete stranger that I've got psychic powers and that I know all about them, or alternatively that, you know, I'm in touch with their dead relative and I'm picking up the information that way, whichever. If you come out with statements like, I'm getting that you've got a lot of unused potential. You've achieved a lot in life, but there's so much more you could achieve if you could just tap in. And we all of us think, oh, yeah, that is so true of me.
You know? My God.
And don't realize.
Have they hit the nail on the head?
Yes, exactly. And now, people can be just so, so impressed.
Unfortunately, we're not going to get into the, because I like the term of the Sherlock Holmes fallacy, that people can easily do a reading by just looking at scraps of information that are on the person. That doesn't happen either, though.
No, not really.
I wish it did.
Again, yeah. I mean, it's kind of it's a nice idea, and I mean, I love the Sherlock Holmes story and the Sherlock Holmes character, but the idea that just by kind of taking a look at someone, you can you know what they've been doing for the last 6 weeks is just. No, it's nonsense. And also, I mean, in the same way that just even kind of the idea of nonverbal communication, I mean, that is a real thing. But the notion that you can tell all kinds of very specific details from subtle nonverbal cues, it's overplayed.
We're completely out of time, and we've only just started to talk about this book. My returning guest tonight, Chris French. He's emeritus professor and head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the psychology department of Goldsmiths, University of London. And we're talking about we continued our conversation about his book, The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal. There's so much in this book. It's amazing. I strongly recommend it. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.